part 6 in the series on the stimulus package, and we are going to be going through part 2 of Title 3 in H.R. 748, the CARES Act. This section covers access to health care for COVID-19 patients. And as the list of symptoms continues to get longer, the virus continues to mutate, and previously safe places experience a resurgence in viral cases, this section is more important than ever. It is important to note that the virus is now having an increased effect in children, causing immune overdrive conditions that can and have resulted in death. This is
Lessons from the screen. John Boy.
Welcome to Lessons from the Screen, the show where we give you a review of whether or not any information that you can get from any particular screen of any particular kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. You are always welcome. You know the deal. We say the same thing before every show. Definitely make sure to go on over to our sponsor's website, www.pactsinc.org. That's pactsinc.org. They are still a black activist advocacy and think tank organization aiming to increase the quality of life for black people in America through a focus on culture shift, economics, and education. And you can do whatever you can to help them, because they're doing whatever they can to help you by going over there, taking a survey, giving a donation, telling a friend to tell a friend, becoming a member, reading a book, doing whatever you can in the learning center, however you choose to help out, help out. And without further ado, much ado to you for listening to this show. We gonna get into what we get into. Howdy ho. So last week we covered part 1 of Title 3, and this week we're going to jump right into part 2 of Title 3, which covers, as I said earlier, healthcare for COVID-19 patients. And it starts with subpart A, which covers the coverage of testing and preventative services. So we start with section 3201, which focuses on coverage of diagnostic testing for COVID-19. And it essentially puts private health insurance companies on the hook for COVID-19 testing, even if those tests have not been approved by the FDA. Now, payment for tests that have not received FDA approval is contingent on the developer requesting or intending to request emergency use authorization within a reasonable time. And if a test has already been denied emergency use authorization, then the insurance company can refuse to pay. Tests developed and authorized in a state that has notified HHS, Health and Human Services, that the state intends to review the test are also on the list, along with tests that have HHS guidance on their appropriateness. Now, 3202 covers the pricing of testing, and it requires that insurance companies reimburse healthcare providers the cost of COVID testing. The section calls for a negotiated rate that covers the duration of the declared emergency, but if a negotiated price hasn't been agreed to, then the insurer has to pay the provider an amount equal to the cash price for services rendered as listed on the provider's public website, or negotiate an amount or in a price that is less than the cash price listed for those services. Now, this is followed up by mandating that the price for COVID testing be listed on the website of providers. Providers of COVID testing that do not have prices listed on their website are subject to a penalty of $300 per day that the violation is ongoing. This fine is at the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And to me, that I'm not even going to get into a rant here. That's stupid. How are you going to have a fine here, but then say the fine is at the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services? There should be an organized and standardized procedural way that companies can get out of paying the fines that are contingent upon their ability to do certain things, not their ability to have a relationship with the Health and Human Services Secretary. Like that does not sit well with me, and that goes into a lot of the things going on here. These things in a lot of cases are structured in such a way where nepotism and cronyism can come into play here, where the Secretary of Labor has a tremendous amount of power throughout this law, the Secretary of Treasury has a tremendous amount of power throughout this law, and here in this section we're seeing the Secretary of Health and Human Services has an extraordinary amount of power and reach with regards to the things mentioned here. Those individuals should not be able to, at their discretion, with no oversight, as we're seeing, because these things, when they say at the discretion of the secretary, they are solely at the discretion of the secretary with no guidelines to determine what is acceptable and appropriate and what isn't. But that should not be the case. These guys should not have the unilateral power to say you have to pay a fee and you don't. Your state can get access to this and your state can't. Your state will have to suffer penalties and fines for this particular instance or this particular occurrence while your state won't. And I am the type of person, I like, even if they want to say, well, there are soft rules in place. Soft rules being rules that aren't written into law where you can't read anywhere. They're more customs, courtesies, and traditions about what typically happens. I want to see stuff like that in writing. You know, I don't, you know, like we're seeing with this administration as far as the president is going, soft regulations, soft rules, traditions, customs, courtesies, they only apply when someone respects them. When somebody doesn't respect them, there is nothing in place that prevents someone from doing something that is against or rails against or outright destroys historic customs, courtesies, and traditions. Now, sure, there will be public backlash, but even that public backlash is only carried so far as the amount of social pressure that can be levied. And even that, again, is only predicate on or the action or a result from that is still predicate on the person who is violating these soft traditions, these soft laws, caring about what society thinks of them. If the person doesn't care, then social pressure is meaningless. And so I don't like this. I don't like the fact that in this case, the $300 per day fine can be waived at the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. End of rant. Now, Section 3203 covers rapid coverage of preventative services and vaccines for coronavirus. And it requires the items, services, or immunizations that are intended to prevent or mitigate COVID-19 and that have an effect rating of A or B in the current recommendations of the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force be covered within 15 days of being recommended instead of the usual year that companies are given. Now, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force ratings are suggestions and beliefs about, based on information about how effective a particular item, medical device, treatment, whatever it is going to be towards a benefit to a particular issue. So a grade of A means that the USPSTF, the United States Preventative Service Task Force, recommends the service. There is a high certainty that net benefit is substantial. And the suggestions for practice are that services with an A grade be offered or provided. Then there's grade B, which is the USPSTF recommends the service. There is a high certainty that the net benefit is moderate, or there is a moderate certainty that the net benefit is moderate to substantial. And this is also a service that is recommended to be provided or offered. Now, there are five grades of this. A and B are the two highest ones. C is the next after B. D is the next after C. And I is the next after D. Now, those three lower grades actually are all pretty much saying that they don't really have enough evidence to support the use of whatever it is that is being graded in question. D, obviously, they discourage the use of that service. And I simply means that patients should understand that there are uncertainties about the effectiveness of whatever it is. So getting an I is basically an incomplete. They just don't know enough about it. A D is a bad grade altogether. A C is a neutral grade. It's only recommended that those services be offered if other considerations support the offering or provide the service to an individual patient. So from there, there are also certainty levels regarding the net benefit. So there are three levels of certainty, and this is very similar to the FBI levels of certainty, where you have a high level of certainty. The available evidence usually includes consistent results from well-designed, well-conducted studies and representative primary care populations. These studies assess the effects of the preventative service on health outcomes. This conclusion is therefore unlikely to be strongly affected by the results of future studies. So that's a high. Basically, they're pretty confident in the net benefit capabilities of something. Then there's moderate. The evidence is sufficient to determine the effects of the preventative service on health outcomes, but confidence in the estimate is constrained by such factors as the number, size, or quality of individual studies, the inconsistency of findings across individual studies, and the limited the limited generalizability of findings to routine primary care practice, and the lack of coherence in the chain of evidence. So, and really here you're just looking at more information becoming available, which could swing one way or the other. So they believe one thing, but they don't believe it to such a degree that they believe the new information won't shift one way or another. This is kind of in the middle. And then there's low certainty. The availability of evidence is insufficient to assess effects on health outcomes. Evidence is insufficient because of a limited number or size of studies, the important flaws in study design or methods, inconsistency in findings across individual studies, gaps in chain of evidence. Findings not generalizable to, I smashed it that time. Did you hear I flow through that? Anyways, findings not generalizable. Oh, did it again. To a routine primary care practice, lack of information on important healthcare outcomes. And so everything we're dealing with regards to COVID-19 is going to be an I or an L. But this particular section is more forward looking in terms of once treatments, medicinal practices, processes, items, things of that nature start getting grades of A or B, it's going to be recommended that insurance companies make the adjustment to policies to cover these things immediately, within 15 days instead of the year-long reprieve that they're usually given. And it's important to understand that they're talking about net benefit here. So this isn't necessarily talking about something that is 100% good with no bad. No, there are always going to be negatives to any sort of medical treatment. There's always going to be a downside to doing something to the body, whether that's an insignificant or minuscule downside, one that's not even worth mentioning because it won't even be noticed, or whether it's a major downside. But what they're talking about here is the net positive. That means, does the good outweigh the bad, essentially? You know, will chopping your arm off save your life? Obviously, chopping your arm off is an extremely drastic measure. That's a huge negative to lose an arm. But it's an even bigger negative to lose your life because you did not lose that arm. So that's what we're talking about here. So anyways, moving forward and jumping right back in to where we were left off on 3203, immunizations that have received a recommendation from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also must be covered within 15 days of receiving their recommendations. Now, we move into subpart B, which covers support for healthcare providers. Now, 3211, notice we were doing the 3230 series. Now we're doing the 321 series. Anyways, 3211 covers supplementary awards for health centers, and it allots $1.32 billion for fiscal year 2020 for the detection, prevention, and diagnosis and treatment of COVID-19. Now, 3212, everybody in it, put your hands up for, 3212 covers telehealth network and telehealth resource centers grant programs, and it expands the telehealth programs by funding them through 2025 at a rate of $29 million a year for evidence-based services and technology. It also adds mental health and substance abuse services to telehealth programs while requiring that 50% of funds must be awarded to projects in rural areas. Within 4 years of the enactment of this law and every 5 years afterwards, a report will be submitted to the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions of the Senate and the Committee on Energy and Commerce of the House of Representatives on the activities and outcomes of the grant programs funded. Now, 3213 covers rural healthcare services outreach, rural health network development, and small healthcare provider quality improvement grant programs. Now, it expands the rural healthcare services by $79.5 million a year through 2025, and it also allows for grants to entities that are not nonprofits but that offer healthcare services to rural areas. Grants can extend for more than 5 years at a time, and it has the same report requirements as the report mentioned in section 3212. Now, 3214 covers U.S. Public Health Service modernization, and this section covers the USPHS Corps, the United States Public Health Service Corps, which is one of the 8 uniformed services in the U.S. You have the 5 armed services, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, and the Coast Guard. I know a lot of y'all be forgetting about the Coast Guard, but don't forget about the Coast Guard. They do a damn good job guarding the coast. I mean, you think about it, America's never been invaded. I mean, I know we got 2 oceans that help with that and a whole bunch, you know, I get it, but, you know, hey, man, don't sleep on the Coast Guard, all right? Don't sleep on the Coast Guard, because when you need them on the coast, they're going to be on the coast. And when you off the coast looking for somebody to bring you back to the coast, then you're going to need the Coast Guard. You feeds me. Anyways, so you got the five armed forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and the Coast Guard, last but not least. And then you have the 2 non-armed branches, which include the Public Health Services and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Both the PHS and the NOAA Corps contain only commissioned officers, and they can also be militarized should the need arise. Now, the PHS has the stated mission of protecting, promoting, and advancing the health and safety of the nation, and their officers deploy nationally in support of public health responses to man-made and natural disasters, and include medical doctors, dentists, nurses, therapists, pharmacists, scientists, vets, engineers, and more. And this law makes changes to the benefits programs provided by 2 members of the Public Health Service Corps. And it also allows for it allows for the deployment of the Ready Reserve Corps of the USPHS. And so that's all a good thing. It brings them up to speed, allows their families to get better benefits should they pass away or should they have other issues. It allows them to get better benefits while they're a member of the Corps of this government service branch. And, oh, in case you were wondering what that 8th branch was, because I only mentioned 7, the 5 armed services to the 2 public sector corps, that one is the Space Force. And since the Space Force was just created, we don't really, I mean, we could suspect that it's gonna be an armed branch, but we don't really know, because it could just be what NASA is, in which case it would not be an armed force. Right. The Space Force. I still can't believe they didn't give it a better name than the damn Space Force. And for those of you, we did talk about the Space Force in a show. And you got to go back and look at it. I don't remember exactly which show it was. We done well over 100 of these things. But we did do a show on the Space Force. It was interesting. Anyways, moving forward, 3215 focuses on limitations on liability for volunteer healthcare professionals during COVID-19 emergency response. And this section confers immunity to volunteer healthcare professionals for negligence that occurs while providing services as a volunteer. They must be acting within the scope of their license and must be rendering services that they believe are needed and justified. And they also must not be under the influence of substances or acting with criminal intent, gross negligence, reckless misconduct, or a conscious flagrant indifference to the rights and safety of the individual harmed. Now, this only lasts for the duration of the public health emergency and is the law in all locations except those locations where the state or local laws offer greater protections than this law does. So this was basically put in place in case there were any slow moving states out there that had healthcare professionals that were providing volunteer services. That means they were providing services with no compensation whatsoever. And those people were concerned about being sued, having liability claims placed against them for, any harm they might cause while doing what they felt like was the right thing. This piece comes in and says, nah, bruh, you can't touch them. Which, I'm all for it. I don't know that people should be harmed, but I don't know that I like giving people immunity from liability either. Because I've said this before and I'm going to say it again. I really dislike the sacrificing of safety for the sake of speed and quote unquote efficiency of service. Honestly, I feel like in these times, things should get more strict, not less strict, because there are a number of people, as we've seen, that are trying to take advantage of the situation. There are a number of people, as we've seen, that are spreading misinformation. And there are a lot of doctors and healthcare professionals, as we've seen, that are not as knowledgeable as a lot of us would want them to be, given their credentials, their access, and the level of trust they have in the public society. A lot of these people are just as susceptible to misinformation and bullshit-ass theories as the rest of Americans. And it's even more dangerous because they have an MD or some sort of professional license behind them that allows them to gain the trust of people immediately and to actually act in a very harmful way on these beliefs. That poses a very serious problem that something like this could potentially open the door for, especially if someone genuinely believes that a particular piece of bad information is good information and acts on it. The harm that they do should be liable for it. Now, it's one thing if they were operating on credible, reputable information and all of the studies are done and they're giving their clients and they're letting their patients know that this is something that is a risk or this is whatever. But I've been in situations and I've heard about, read about, and seen other people in situations where a healthcare professional believed a myth and was acting on that myth as if that myth was fact. And something like this would potentially allow a healthcare provider or healthcare professional in that situation with those beliefs to get away with having with any concerns about being liable for any damage they may cause. And again, I say that should not be the case. Those people should be held responsible. I think if you tighten the laws in these regards, if you tighten the restrictions and the regulations, you force people to make sure in this state of heightened panic and heightened awareness of what's happening with people's bodies and this belief that everybody is sick with COVID, it forces doctors and healthcare professionals of all stripes to ensure that they are up to date on the most current information, that they are not acting on myths or on information that is not sufficient enough to be acted on before it is proven to be sufficient enough to be acted on. And then it forces them to really make sure that they are doing their due diligence when it comes to treating patients that are looking to them to treat them with any miracle drug right away. I think that is mandatory. Now, I understand it might slow down the healthcare industry, and I understand a lot of people think the healthcare industry is moving too slow as it is. But honestly, in situations like this, I would rather the healthcare industry move slow than fast. I do not like the rate of change and the rate of the level of flexibility that people are being given right now during this situation. I don't like it from the pharmacist to the medical professionals to, and it's just my personal opinion. But I would rather you, you know, there's an old saying, measure twice, cut once. I would rather you take your time and do a good job the first time than to be dealing with all of these other negative occurrences that come from you trying to act quickly and making mistakes and jacking shit up. I'm just saying. That's all I'm saying. I'm just saying. Anyways. And section 3216 is titled Flexibility for Members of the National Health Service Corps with during the emergency period. Now, this section allows the Secretary of Health and Human Services during a declared national emergency to assign members of the National Healthcare Service Corps to sites other than their original sites in order to respond to emergencies. Now, the Corps members being reassigned has to voluntarily agree to the temporary reassignment, and the number of hours required at the new site has to be the same as the number of hours originally required at the original site, and the original site has to be within a reasonable distance. I'm sorry, the reassignment site, the new site, has to be at a reasonable distance to the original assignment. That was a tongue twister. It really wasn't. But anyways, moving on to the final section that we're going to cover on this day, subpart C, and it is titled Miscellaneous Provisions. Provisions. Yeah, I roll my R's. I've been working on my Spanish for the last 15 years. Yep. Anyways, 3221, which is different from the last section, which was 321. And then the section before that was 32-0. So now we're in 32-2. But I'm not 32 because I'm older than 32. But if you're 32 and you're 32, then both of y'all are 32-2. Or you're 32 and he's 32-2. Or she's 32-2. But I'm not 33-3. I'm older than 32. So anyways, 3221 is titled Confidentiality and Disclosure of Records Relating to Substance Use Disorders. And this section first changes confidentiality records laws to address substance abuse disorders instead of substance abuse. And this is an alignment shift that brings these laws into the current thinking on substance abuse issues. It also allows HIPAA consent, everybody know what the HIPPA consent is, to be given once for all future issues if the person giving consent wishes. This consent will remain until the person revokes the consent in writing. It also allows the disclosure of health information as long as that information has been de-identified. It prevents the use of records in civil, criminal, and administrative contexts without a court order or permission from the person. Now, I'm going to interrupt this right here. So I got two problems. One, I don't like opt-out programs. And for those of you that know anything about program development, if you want to get people involved in your program, as many people as possible, you create an opt-out program. Because most people aren't going to take that step to opt out. If you don't want to get a lot of people in and you just want to focus on the people that really want to be a part of the program, then you create an opt-in program. Because most people aren't going to opt in. Whatever it is, the action that you're requiring, most people aren't going to do that action. So if people have to do an action to leave, most people won't leave. And if people have to do an option to get in, most people won't get in. And what this essentially says is that you have to opt, you have to cancel, you have to cancel your HIPAA consent. You give it once and then you have to cancel it. Otherwise, it just goes on and on and on. And I understand that there are a lot of, you know, quote unquote, trustworthy people dealing with these forms that really care about your privacy and your information. And we shouldn't be overly concerned about this. But this is something that's always going to bother me, because if you don't give your consent to cancel your approval, then your approval travels with your documents. And so before you realize it, before you know it, and it's not a stretch to think that at some point a document that was given HIPAA consent for one reason might end up being shared in a totally different context through the chain of events that would end up having that document in the hands of somebody that the person did not want that document in the hands of. And so you run into all sorts of problems when you run into opt-out programs or programs where you have to cancel your subscription. You know, those programs are just, they really get people caught up that aren't paying attention. And unfortunately, most people are not paying attention. Now, second point is the de-identity things. So I got an issue with the de-identity standards placed on documentation. And my issue is that people that are savvy enough, intelligent enough, creative enough, and have access to enough information can make a pretty good guess about who a person is using de-identified information. We see this in face social media data that's been shared with other groups, and all of a sudden that information is used to make very, very, very accurate, educated guesses based on particular populations. And in some cases, although not often, in some cases that can be narrowed down to individual data. When you look at voting and polling information, that information is supposed to be de-identified, but they can tell what party you voted for. You particularly voted for. They can't tell who you voted for, but they can tell what party you voted for. And in some cases, they can probably put two and two together. They can make very educated guesses using de-identified information. Now, again, I understand the necessity for gathering information. I get it. I love gathering it. I don't love gathering information. I mean, not lie. I love analyzing data, though. And so as somebody that loves analyzing data, the more data I have to analyze, the more in heaven I am. The only thing for me, well, let me not go there. Anyways, so that being said, I get it. The need for having this data in order to tell whether a program is operating the way it's supposed to be operating, whether or not a program is discriminating, whether or not a program is doing anything nefarious or simply just not doing its job. You need data and you need personalized data in certain regards in order to make those determinations. But when we start talking about de-identified information being shared, I do think people should have more control over where that information goes. And even in terms of that de-identified information, people should have control over what information is shared. If you do a good job of explaining why the information is needed and gaining the trust of people so that they don't feel like you're going to use their information for nefarious or malicious intent, then you'll have people voluntarily giving up their information, especially if you allow them to control and track where the information is going and to stop the process whenever they want. Now, I understand that that's a very complicated and hard thing to do, but you can't convince me that this government cannot do it. You just can't convince me. You also can't convince me that these healthcare corporations don't have the resources and intellectual capacity to pull something like that off. You just can't convince me of that. So anyways, ran over. Let's get back into it in the middle of 3221. So as I said, this section also prevents the use of records in civil, criminal, or administrative context without a court order or permission. And the information can't be entered into the record or utilized in local or federal courts and can't be used in an application for a warrant. Discrimination through the use of the information in records is also illegal regardless of whether the documents were obtained legally or not. Now, within 1 year of this law passing, the Secretary of Health and Human Services must provide instructions for entities to produce notices regarding the privacy practice changes in personal records policy. And these notices must include the patient's rights, including self-pay patients, and how the individual may exercise their rights, as well as a description of each purpose for which the covered entity is permitted or required to use or disclose protected health information without the patient's written authorization. Now, section 3222 is titled Nutrition Services, and it allows funds to be transferred between group and home nutritional programs without permission in order to meet the needs of the elderly in the state. No more than 100% of the funds received by an agency can be moved, and it allows during the COVID-19 emergency for meals to be delivered to elderly individuals who are practicing social distancing and thus can't meet their nutritional needs, the same as it already provides for elderly that are homebound because of other illnesses. And finally, it provides a waiver on nutritional guidelines at the assistant secretary's discretion. And here you have a combination of two issues that I dislike that I've talked about before. On the one hand, you have the issue that I talked about very early on in this very show, which is the assistant secretary. One person, one office has the ability to waive a penalty. That's not cool. And I've already stated how I feel on that. There's no need to go back into it. But the second issue is an issue that I addressed in one of the previous shows I did. I think it was regarding the second COVID law that was passed, this being the third, so the one before this one, in which we talked about the nutritional program for children and a waiver being passed that allows them to not necessarily hand out food that meets nutritional requirements. I do not like this, Sam I Am. I do not like the way these programs are operating. You know, I do not like this, Sam I Am. I do not like this can of ham. I do not like the fact that these programs do not have to provide adequate nutrition to me. I know that was long, but it did rhyme. Anyways, I do not like the fact that these programs are giving waivers. I understand the need to want to feed people regardless of whether or not they're getting their proper nutritional intake or not. You just want to get them food. I understand that, but I feel like this is a program that should come when it's needed, not in advance. In a world, in a country that's the richest country in the history of the world, we should be able to feed people. And if we cannot feed people properly, we should be able to address that bridge when it comes. I don't like and it's not even that I don't like the fact that the waiver is there. I don't like the fact that the waiver is there with very little oversight, with very little procedural requirements for obtaining it. It is simply at the discretion of the secretary or the assistant secretary. That is not acceptable to me, especially when it comes to feeding the kids. Now, when it comes to feeding the old folks, I still don't think it's acceptable, but again, when it comes to feeding the kids, that's a different thing because now you're impacting their growth and development. You're impacting the entirety of the next generation of children for community, culture, or whatever. You're affecting their height. You're affecting their intellectual capacity. You're affecting their creative capacity. You're affecting their energy levels, their ability to procreate, their ability to handle stress. You're affecting all of that for the duration of their lives, potentially, if you wanted to be nefarious and malicious with this thing. And I don't like the fact that, again, there are no procedural safeguards in place that have a requirement for certain standards that are needed to be reached and achieved in order to get this waiver. That is unacceptable to me. And I don't know that there is a way to make it acceptable outside of creating program structures and infrastructure in place that require certain things to happen. So, Section 3224 requires that within 180 days of this law passing, which is September 23rd, 2020, the Secretary of Health and Human Services has to issue guidance on the sharing of patients' protected health information. And then we have Section 3225, which is a reauthorization of the Healthy Start program, and it appropriates $125.5 million a year through 2025 and extends the Healthy Start program. It also makes adjustments to the program to help reduce the infant mortality and address health disparities. It requires a focus on not just low birth weight data regarding the effectiveness of the program, but it also requires information on poor birth outcomes, which includes low birth rate and other issues, and social determinants of health. It requires the collection and use of data regarding the effectiveness of programs in reducing infant mortality rates and improving perinatal outcomes, as well as the process used to gather data. The Government Accountability Office is also required to conduct an independent evaluation of programs within 4 years of this law passing, and the Comptroller General of the U.S. has to conduct and submit to Congress a report that reviews assesses and provides recommendations on the allocation of Healthy Start program grants, including considerations made regarding disparities in infant mortality and perinatal outcomes among urban and rural areas. Trends in progress, including programs that have and have not had an impact on selected outcomes, awareness of programs and services, and the extent of interagency coordination. And finally, we come to section 3226, which is titled The Importance of Blood Supply, of the Blood Supply. And it requires the Secretary of Health and Human Services to carry out a national campaign to improve awareness of and support outreach concerning the importance and safety of blood donations and the need for donations during the public health emergency declared by the Secretary under Section 319 of the Public Health Services Act. The Secretary is authorized to enter into contracts with one or more public or private nonprofit entities. The Secretary is also required to consult with the Commissioner of the Food and Drugs, the Assistant Secretary of Health, the Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Director of the National Institutes of Health, and the heads of other relevant federal agencies and relevant accrediting bodies and representative organizations. Within 2 years after this law passes, the Secretary has to submit a report to Congress regarding the description of the activities, trends in blood supply donation, and an evaluation of the impact of the public awareness campaign, including any geographic or population variations. Now, that was this. And I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you learned something from it. If you didn't, let me know. If you did, let me know. Let me know what you think and hold it. And as always, if you have questions about some of the details written here, you can either hit me up directly or I always have a link to the law in place, the law in question in the description to the show. So click on that link and by all means, read it for yourself. You know, that's the best way to find out whether or not somebody's giving you accurate information on something that's in writing is to go and freaking read it. Had a blast, and I will see you next week. This is
Lessons from the screen.
John Boy.
So thank you guys for listening to the show, to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you always enjoy it. Remember, you can check out all of the shows. All of them are going to be only found on the Freedom Train Network. That's www.freedomtrainradio.com. And that goes, again, for all of the shows on the network. You can only find all of the shows available for all of the shows on the network on Freedom Train website, www.freedomtrainradio.com. So go there and check them out. You only get the latest 25 shows, I believe, on the podcast directories. So check us out. Show support for all of the shows we have. Shelby's World, Enigma Self Hour, The Fix, Sports Podcast, Freedom Train Podcast Series, and all of the other shows that are around. Definitely go and show them love. As for this show in particular, you can check us out. Support us on Patreon.com. That's patreon.com/LFTS. That's patreon.com/LFTS. And there you can drop us, you can show support by sponsoring the show, giving us money every month, giving us money per episode, and just letting us know that you support us. And by doing such things, you allow us to be able to spend more time creating and composing the shows like this series, and shows like a lot of the series that we do take a lot of time to put together. We're talking about hours upon hours upon hours of research, and it'd be nice to be able to take the time to do those shows and do them correctly the way we really want to do them, and also to be able to do them more frequently, because a lot of these shows should probably be done a lot more frequently. So love you, see you next week, hope you have fun.